Okay, so let me do an introduction. This Mark Shenker. This is the monthly conference call sponsored by the Society of Addiction Psychology, and we are. This is the last one of the year, so you better enjoy it. We are very happy to have Dr. Catherine McHugh from McLean Hospital and Harvard Medical School joining us. She's published more than 100 manuscripts and book chapters and an edited book published by Oxford University Press. She also has a clinical practice specializing in CBT for the treatment of anxiety, depressive, and substance use disorders. A couple of my usual cautions. One is please, please, please press your mute button so we don't listen to the fire alarms and the screaming children in the background. And if you're going to discuss any clinical material, remember that we are recording and please be careful about confidentiality. Our next call is scheduled for January 11th, and tentatively we have Dr. Carlo Di Clemente speaking, and we're going to move on from there. We have a number of really promising speakers lined up for 2019. So having said all that, I think I remembered everything, and press your mute buttons except for Dr. McHugh, and I'm turning the floor over to you.
Great. Thanks so much, Mark. And thanks, everybody, for joining the call, especially on a Friday afternoon. Appreciate everybody's time. And my plan for going through these, I'm going to break every 10 or 15 minutes is going to be my goal, so I'm happy to take questions throughout. So I'll try to pause in case questions come up as we go along. And I'll also walk you through, for those of you who have the slides, I'll walk you through and just orient you to what slide we're on. So I'll be talking today about applying CBT to opioid use disorder. If you click onto the first slide, those are just my disclosures. I don't have any conflicts of interest. And clicking onto the next slide, just to give you a sense, I'll be talking about a number of principles that are applicable to substance use disorders across the board. You know, many of these won't be completely specific to opioids, but what I really want to focus on are what are some of the considerations that are really essential for working with folks with opioid use disorder when you're applying CBT. So moving on to the next slide, one criticism that's popped up in the literature a lot is that the evidence, particularly for adding CBT to buprenorphine maintenance, has been somewhat mixed, and that in many cases, adding CBT has not had a significant additive benefit above and beyond, particularly Suboxone maintenance. There are some methadone trials that say the same as well. And part of what I try to think about is how can CBT be a useful adjunct? And assuming that right now medication really is the frontline standard of care for opioid use disorder, that what can CBT do that the medication can't do? And I think a couple of the reasons why the literature has been a little disappointing in this area is, one, and then several people have written about this, that the medication management conditions in many of the clinical trials have been very robust and have in some cases themselves been a form of counseling or psychotherapy where there are extensive check-ins, there's some sort of good behavioral work happening in those, so maybe that's part of the reason why there hasn't been an effect. I think the other reason is we should be thinking of CBT as filling in the gaps for the things that the medication can't do as well. And that could be playing a role in something like medication adherence. That could be playing a role in managing stress, which is going to be a huge predictor of treatment non-response. So, you know, anytime I'm thinking about adding CBT to medication for someone, it's, you know, what is my role within this treatment team and what are the targets? And in particular, how can I target this treatment to be both complementary and additive to what the person is already getting? So certainly this is a component of a multi-component treatment, making sure that there's also case management. In many cases, self-help and peer supports are really essential for this population. You know, the more of a team you can have around somebody, the better, especially if you're looking at the more severe end of the spectrum. So I want to make, if you move on to the next slide, I'm going to make a quick case. I'm not going to talk a lot about contingency management, but I do want to mention it. Although exceptionally difficult to do logistically, this is an important component of treatment for this population. And the first slide you'll see here, this is a good old-fashioned decisional balance worksheet. And decisional balance can be a wonderful strategy. Your pros cons list can be great for a lot of types of behavior change. I tend to find that this really falls flat for substance use disorders in general and in this population in particular, in part because if you look on the next slide, by the time someone lands in treatment, many cases it is on paper a very, very, very clear decision why they would want to stop using. So if you look at the list of cons that I have here, things like my spouse would leave me, I lose my kid, I could die, I could go to jail, I could lose my job. In many ways, these are the scariest cons you can imagine. This is losing all the things that are important to me. And one of the things that I think is very frustrating for people is, why can't I stop? You know, this seems like a no-brainer. Everybody in my life tells me this is a no-brainer. I could lose everything or have lost everything, and I can't stop. And if you flip on to the next slide, part of this is because when we're looking at behavior change in this context, it's not just about pro and con, it's about the timing. So I'm going to ask everybody actually to do a brief exercise with me. Again, you can click on to the next slide if you'd like. I want everyone to take a moment and think about your favorite guilty pleasure food. The thing that you eat that you probably shouldn't eat, that's probably not so good for you. And if you click on this, you can see my ice cream cone. That is my guilty pleasure food. And if you use that as an example, and you think this is something that had all the cons that substance use or opioid use would have, you know, if you keep eating that, if I keep eating this ice cream, I could lose my job, I could lose my family support, it could kill me. That's a pretty good case for not eating your guilty pleasure food. But if you think about the day that I walk past the ice cream shop and I can smell the ice cream, I can smell the fresh baked cones, I can hear people inside laughing. If I walk by the ice cream shop, the benefits that I get in the moment are tiny, if any. I get no benefit in the moment of walking past the ice cream shop. You know, maybe a small sense of victory in walking past, but any victory I get in not using in that moment is small, it's distal, it's a contribution to an outcome that's going to happen much farther down the road. If in that moment, again, you go in, you get that ice cream cone or eat that guilty pleasure food, all the benefits come immediately. It's the costs that come later. So when we're thinking about how do we sort of support people around that behavior change, it is so hard to change a behavior when its reinforcement is distal. You can use this. Other example I use for this is exercise. The worst possible reason to try to exercise is for long-term health. Because if you run today, the contribution to your long-term health is far in the future. It's hard to measure. It's hard to quantify. What you really want to try to do is, as much as we can, link that reinforcement as close to the behavior as possible. And this is part of the reason, among others, why this is exceptionally difficult. So if you skip forward to the next slide, and I apologize if there's some animation in there, you might just have to click through. When we think about contingency management, it's how do we move the reinforcement closer to the behavior? That if I use opioids, in the moment I will very quickly get a sense of euphoria, I could get a reduction in my anxiety and reducing my pain. If I choose to abstain in this moment, my benefits are so long-term. So anything you can do to move that reinforcement closer is good. You know, certainly many of the clinical trials looking at contingency management have focused on financial incentives or vouchers, but you know, if there's any opportunity to leverage the family system to use non-monetary incentives, where whether those be incentives for clean urines, for showing up for treatment, it requires some being creative, but anything you can do to move that reinforcement up can be of benefit. Any questions about any of that before we shift gears to the next piece?
Hi, this is Mark. I have one quick question about something earlier on. Sure. And I'm familiar with literature that says that, you know, buprenorphine alone is as helpful as buprenorphine plus counseling. Or I know that there's some equivocal data there, but is there any, has anyone looked at whether psychotherapy aids in the compliance with the medication regimen?
There is a little bit of data on that with naltrexone. I don't believe there is with Suboxone, although I'd have to double check. One interesting, speaking of compliance, I think another reason why many of those trials have been equivocal is that the compliance with the behavior therapy has been very low. So if you actually look at many of those trials, people on average are getting something like 3 or 4 sessions, which I doubt any of us would argue is a sufficient dose of behavioral therapy. So that I do think is a different issue, but using behavior therapy to enhance compliance with medication I think is really underutilized and could be an important role.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so moving on, if you click through to the next slide, I'll talk briefly about functional analysis, which I think is really just the foundational CBT skill, particularly for substance use disorders, in part because these disorders are so varied. They're really heterogeneous, and sort of how people get to these disorders and what role substance use is playing functionally varies tremendously from person to person. So when we're talking about functional analysis, it's looking at the surrounding context, the triggers, and really, essentially, what is the function of substance use? Anything that we do, good, bad, or indifferent, we do for one of two reasons. It makes us feel more good, or it makes us feel less bad. And what this is doing is really trying to understand how is substance use playing into that person's behavior. So clicking through to the next slide, this is an exercise that I do with people, sort of depending on the person. Adolescents tend to really like this. Is oftentimes I'll draw a circle, and I will ask people to sort of fill in a little pie chart for me and tell me what are the components of their life right now, and how much of the pie do those different components take. And in many cases, when someone is really struggling and they're coming into treatment, substance use is a huge piece of that pie. Sometimes it's almost all of the pie. And one of the points that I try to make to people is, so we're talking about pulling out that huge piece of the pie, and what are you left with in that case? And in many cases, people are left with a big hole. It's something that has taken up a lot of time, a lot of energy, and it's really essential to replace the pros of use, you know, the benefits. What is someone getting out of their opioid use, and how are we going to find alternatives to plug into that gap? A good basic behavior change principle is it is easier to replace a behavior than to remove a behavior. So that's really where this can come into play. If you look at the next slide, that's just a very simple functional analysis worksheet. Certainly you can do simpler versions of this or more complex versions, depending on the person. Things like literacy level or sort of psychological mindedness can all play a role in whether or not you would want to use this or something more complex. And what you'll see here is the really important piece is not just to look at both the trigger and the behavior, but to break consequences into short-term and long-term. Because when we're looking at pretty much any maladaptive behavior, certainly opioid use would fit into this, generally the benefits are in the short-term, the costs are in the long-term. And parceling those out can be really important. If you click through to the next slide, I just have a couple of examples from people who I've worked with. That you can take a peek at. The first one is more of an external trigger. So this is someone who was actually at a basketball tournament in a neighborhood where he used to buy opioids, and he was playing a little bit of a sort of Russian roulette and saying, I'm just going to call my dealer and see if he picks up. And if he picks up, maybe I'll do something. If he doesn't, then I'll keep walking. He is someone who ended up relapsing in that situation, again, with short-term benefits and long-term costs. The second example here is a little bit more of an internal trigger, where someone was feeling low, he was feeling tired, feeling a bit hopeless, like things wouldn't get better. He, at that point, unfortunately, actually unintentionally found pills in an old pants pocket, took them, felt much better, but again, in the long term, had some consequences. So you're seeing two examples here where you would intervene differently because use is playing a different role in those two situations and really thinking about what is the alternative there. So if you click forward to the next slide, again, you want alternatives to the behavior, not just stopping the behavior, but what are you going to plug in there? And if you skip forward to the next slide, you can think of there are two places to intervene. You can intervene at the point of the trigger, or you can intervene at the point of the behavior. And in many cases, if the trigger is something that is truly avoidable, then it's great to get rid of the trigger. So, something like a drug dealer, presumably is someone that someone could cut out of their lives. In that case, you can remove that trigger. In many cases, you can't remove the trigger. So stress is a good example. You can try to mitigate stress, but you can't remove it entirely. Other triggers like family members, if someone wants to maintain connection with family, it might be something where the focus needs to be more on building tolerance to that trigger. In many cases, and I think the AA community does this a lot, is there's a lot of focus on avoidance early in treatment, which in many cases makes sense, but in many cases is also not sustainable, that we also do need to be building tolerance of these triggers so that people can continue to engage. So skipping to the next slide, these are just sort of a few examples. Certainly things like deleting and blocking phone numbers that people need to get rid of, not contacting friends who use, staying out of triggering situations. These are all ways to change triggers. Asking significant others not to use. And for the internal triggers is making sure that those things are being addressed or treated. A couple of examples I've given here I'll actually talk about a little bit later as well. Things like insomnia, which is a tremendously important treatment target in this population, which I'll talk about a little bit. Depression, pain, anxiety, that if those are things that we can actually treat with CBT, again, this is a place where it can play a really important adjunctive role in this population. One other note, if you actually flip to the next slide, one of the places where I think this becomes easier said than done, and this is actually twofold. One is in opioid use disorder, and you see this in other substance use disorders, over time you see people shift more from a reward motive for use to more of a relief motive for use. So early on someone may use to feel better, to engage more socially, to get that sense of euphoria. And once someone's a little later in the disorder course, it is almost all about relief. And whether that's relieving withdrawal or pain or chronic negative affect, that it is use just to feel normal, not necessarily use to feel good. So really sort of supporting people around better managing those situations like negative affect or stress, better tolerating those in the short term so they can get to the other side of that is a really important component. The other thing that can happen, again, this is where functional analysis can be a little easier said than done, is when you see the shift to habit-based behavior. And the example I always think of with this is a young man who I saw who was struggling quite a bit with getting clean, and he was someone who's a big Celtics fan. So he was a smart guy, clearly. And we would talk about, he'd come in at the beginning of the session, and he would always talk about how the Celtics had done the night before. And he came in one day, and he sat down, and he said, I picked up again last night. The Celtics won, and I had to celebrate. I had to do something, and I was really craving, so I used. And in the moment, I sort of paused and reflected back to him that when the Celtics won, he wanted to use. When the Celtics lost, he wanted to use. When the Celtics didn't play, he wanted to use. And in that situation, that's one where the use had become so habitual and not necessarily even linked to a trigger, where absolutely anything could be a trigger. It was just sort of this constant desire for some shift in the way he felt. In large part, that's the physiological dependence, but it also sort of shows how over time these things can actually become unlinked from triggers and just almost more habit-based or rote-based in and of themselves. In those cases, again, this is sort of further case in point for where medication plays a really, really essential role, not only in sort of supporting people around craving, but also in the case that someone does slip up, preventing overdose. And I'm going to shift over to skills practice now, but this might be another good place to break if there are any thoughts or questions.
This is Erica Bloom. I have a question, and it's nice to talk to you again. I don't think we've talked since internship.
Yeah, likewise. I'm glad to hear your name.
Yeah, this is a great presentation. So one issue that I often run into with my patients, and most of my patients are for cigarette smoking cessation, but there are so many parallels here. I mean, it is identical, and I use an identical strategies for treatment. But when I'm trying to generate alternatives for them, so those activities that are going to replace smoking behavior, I have a lot of patients who are very limited in terms of what they're able to do due to their medical and or psychiatric conditions. A lot of them don't have a lot of, they're very limited in finances, they don't have a lot of money, they have limited mobility, limited ability to leave the house, and so they often tell me, well, I have to be at home all day and there's nothing else that I can do except smoke. So I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on suggestions for someone in that situation who is disabled physically and has limited finances and transportation, like what sorts of activities they might replace substance use with, because I imagine there are people with opioid use disorder who have a similar situation.
Yeah, absolutely. So I would say twofold. One challenge, and this applies both to smoking and to opioids, is one uphill piece of the battle for us is I can't think of a single thing that I can suggest to someone that's going to work as quickly and in many respects as well in the short term as a cigarette or an opioid will. Mm-hmm. So that's a little bit of part of our issue, is that in the short term, it's hard to compete with those strategies. So that's one thing that I'll actually sort of circle back to. I would say the second piece to this is you're talking about the folks, and to use the opioid parallel here, is folks with chronic pain, severe medical issues, in many cases homebound, limited financial resources. This, to some extent, is where I think it's actually really essential to engage case management, social services, anything that you can get that can sort of bring community as close to that person as possible and engage them in community. Because you're right, I mean, if you can't leave the house, if you're dealing with sort of medical issues, you know, there are things that we can engage people with. We could work on some coping skills and some mindfulness, and you know, there's some of that stuff that you can engage, but that's not going to carry somebody all the time. Right. You really do need some kind of heterogeneity, some kind of connection. So I think for folks I work with, I work a lot with any kind of community organization we can get them involved in, whether it's self-help or other kinds of community, and really sort of leveraging case management services as much as possible. This is where you see sort of social determinants of health to some extent make as much of a difference as anything else in that context.
Absolutely.
Does that sort of get at what you're saying?
Yeah, I appreciate that response, and that's generally the direction I go in as well, trying to get them more social connections. So I ask them, like, are there people that you could call on the phone to talk to, or is there, you know, a service that can come to where you are, or any place where you could get to by walking, like things like the library and places like that. So it sounds like you have similar thoughts. So I appreciate that.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, those are the tough situations. Again, if you add something like chronic pain on board, the less activity somebody has and the more isolated, that's actually going to make the pain worse too. Snowball effect.
Many of my cigarette smoking patients also use opioids for pain. They don't necessarily have opioid use disorder, but they're on opioids.
Yeah. Great. Thanks, Erica. That was a great question. All right. And I'll talk a little bit about coping as well. So I'll shift gears now. We'll talk a little bit about skills practice, and coping will be part of that. So if you're on the skills practice slide, this is the other, you know, if you think of functional analysis as part of skill one of CBT, the skills practice is really what you do with that functional analysis once you've figured that out. And to some extent, this can take a lot of different forms. You know, in many cases, especially for opioids, the age of onset of use tends to be pretty early. And in many cases, there's even if it wasn't opioids that started early, there was something else that started early. And there are many developmental milestones that either get missed or skills that get rusty. And this can be anything from problem solving to interpersonal skills, coping skills. And I'm going to talk about, focus mostly on coping, but the analogy I always use for folks who I'm working with is if you're looking to learn a new skill like coping skills, that rehearsal is essential. So if I use the analogy, if I want to try to teach someone how to play the violin or shoot a free throw, you know, we could talk about it for hours. We could talk about it in every level of detail. You could read every book you want to read. But until you actually start rehearsing that, you're not going to learn much of anything. So whenever I'm sort of thinking about skills practice, I want to be doing this in the session as much as possible, you know, capitalizing on any affect in the session to try to start to rehearse these skills. Certainly using outside of the session exercises can be helpful, but if you can do it in the session, absolutely engage folks. And flipping over to the next slide, we'll talk a little bit about coping first, where again you see opioids provide tremendous relief of stress. In many cases, our endogenous opioid system is the brain's natural stress-off system. So these are really, really potent substances when it comes to mitigating stress. So engaging people in other skills is important, but the other component to this is this issue of distress tolerance, which, and if you flip over to the next slide, and again, there might be a little animation there that you have to click through. If you think of distress intolerance as having two components, the first one is a sensitivity to distress. So the sense that I can't handle this, I don't like this, this is dangerous, I don't like the way it feels. And in that case, you get sort of an amplification of distress, almost an anxious responding to distress. So if I feel pain or anger or depression and I feel like I can't handle it, it's dangerous, it's actually going to amplify that distress. The corresponding component to this is a lack of persistence. So if I can't handle this, I hate it, it feels bad, I want to get rid of it, and I want to get rid of it as soon as possible. And this is really where you can see substances play a role, again, because they can get you that quick benefit. And to some extent, this is something we really contend with opioid use disorder. If you flip over to the next slide, I promise this is the only data slide I have. And this is really just to demonstrate that this is pertinent across the severity of opioid misuse. So on the left is actually looking at distress intolerance in people with chronic pain who were prescribed opioids. And what you're looking at here is folks who misuse their opioids, so who use more, who may use someone else's opioids, who are using more often, are much more intolerant of their distress than people who are able to adhere to their medication regimen. If we look at the other end of the severity spectrum, the slide on the right, these are folks with opioid use disorder receiving methadone maintenance treatment. And here you can see, and I won't go too much into the weeds of this, but across a few different types of distress, so pain, respiratory discomfort, frustration, and sadness, people with opioid use disorder have greater intolerance of all of these types of distress, not only just relative to healthy people, but also relative to people with psychiatric disorders like depression and anxiety. So this is a very common feature in opioid misuse and opioid use disorder. And how this really plays out is if I'm so intolerant of my own distress that I feel like I have to get rid of it quickly, it's hard to select an adaptive coping strategy. Because if I have something that will work very quickly, it's very hard for me to say, well, I could call someone and have sort of a slower decrease in my distress, or I could put on my sneakers and go for a walk and get, again, sort of that slower response. So in many ways, not only are we helping people to cope by introducing new skills and supporting them around coping, but another essential piece is how do we sort of train people to tolerate their distress for long enough to select something adaptive? And this, in many cases, is hard to do. This is really foreign for a lot of people, but you know, strategies like even getting people to sit with their distress in the session a little bit better to get them to label it and, you know, sort of add some language to what they're actually feeling in the moment to try to reinforce the idea that they can be safe while feeling these sensations. can be a really important part of engaging the coping plan. So moving on to the next slide, talking a little bit about coping plans. These are just some important tips for coping plans. Really good to be collaborative, and you know, to Erica's point, you know, there may be limitations in terms of what people can access. So this is where it's really useful to be collaborative and get a sense of what people do and do not have access to. When you get the skeptic, and I love a skeptic in this situation where someone says, nothing's going to work, nothing's going to work, nothing's going to work, one good way to try to counter that is to say, you may be absolutely right. Let's take an empirical approach. You know, if you, or a scientific approach, if you give this a fair shot and you prove to me that this doesn't work, great, I won't bring it up again, and we'll try something different. So I think that can be another way to try to engage the skeptics. And if you move on to the next slide, I think the what of the coping plan is not the difficult part. You know, if we had everybody throw out 5 suggestions, we could probably get a list of 100 different ways to cope with stress, you know, even on this call. I think it's the implementation that gets really hard. So a couple of components to this. Here are just some tips on the coping plan. The first one you'll see here is no one wants to be told to do deep breathing. And I had a young woman walk into my office once, very first time I met her. And she came in, didn't even sit down, walks right over to me, and I will censor this because this is being recorded and my mother would be unhappy with me otherwise. Walks right up to me, censored version is, if you tell me to deep breathe, you're going out that window. She points to my window. And it was a really good reminder to me of a couple different things. One is it's really essential to validate somebody's experience when you're engaging in a coping plan. Because you can imagine if you're sitting across from somebody and you're just rattling off, here are other things that you can do. In many ways, that can be perceived as really invalidating of somebody's distress, which is, this is hard. It is not easy to engage in these coping strategies. And you know what, I probably could have come up with these ideas on my own. This isn't easy to do. So validating people around how difficult this is enormously important. I think the other lesson in this young woman's point to me is that you also have to think about the intensity of the distress. Is, you know, that there are situations and there are coping skills that will work really well at low levels of distress that aren't going to touch you at a high level of distress. So really considering and having a conversation with people around, you know, what can you do when you're starting to crave or when you're starting to get angry or anxious? And, you know, what are the 10 alarm fire strategies that you can use when you're so upset, you're so stressed, you're so distressed that many skills aren't going to work, including most of the cognitive skills. Anything that's going to require any kind of cognitive skill, when you're a 10 out of 10, it's just not going to work in many cases. So really making sure that you're sort of discussing that component to it, I think, is important, which relates to the next tip, which is the more variety, the better. Having some easy strategies, some more difficult strategies, strategies that involve other people, strategies you could engage in at 3 o'clock in the morning. You know, the more variety, the more options, the better. Third tip on this is to think like a marathon runner. So another analogy I'll use for people is we wait too long to cope with stress. And by that I mean we wait until we feel stressed to cope with stress. So if you think of a marathon runner, there are a lot of things that are important to do the day of a race. You know, you should make sure you got a good night's sleep the night before. You should be hydrated. You should probably have carb loaded. You should have the right equipment on. You should be, you know, dressed for the weather. You should stretch. Those things are all essential to do, and if you don't do them, the race isn't going to go well. But where the race really goes poorly is if you haven't done your training the 6 months before. And to some extent, I think that's how a lot of people think about coping, is I cope when the stress hits. And if you're not doing the work before the stress hits, you're like that marathon runner who is well-stretched and has the right sneakers but hasn't run in 6 months. So really engaging people a lot in how do you cope proactively? How do you build resilience to stress so when it does hit, you're in a better position to manage it? And this could be anything from, you know, engaging in regular exercise, sleep, you know, any kind of mindfulness practice. It can be, again, the what is not that important, but really engaging people, and you should be thinking about coping all the time. And if you're not doing it reactively, you should also be doing it proactively. And just the fourth tip here, and we've talked about this a little bit, is also removing any barriers to the plan. So if the plan is, I'm going to call a supportive person when I'm feeling really stressed, you want that person identified. You want the number in the phone. And again, you don't want that first phone call to be the day that they're really struggling. I was just talking to somebody about this a couple of days ago in my office where they said, I don't know if I'll call this person. It was their brother. I don't know if I'll feel comfortable calling my brother when I'm having a really strong craving. And what I suggested to this person is I said, just get in the habit of calling him to say hi, calling him on a day that you're not stressed or not craving, so that you've sort of broken through that barrier of picking up the phone and making the call, so that when you really need it, it's easier to make. And actually, I'll shift gears to craving next, but before we do that, I'll just pause. Any questions about any of that?
Brandon Reed, I have a quick question.
Sure.
When you're getting the person acclimated to, for example, making the phone calls to you know, the patient's brother, would it be a good idea, medium idea, bad idea to inform the brother of the plan that he is part of that coping strategy if the patient is feeling urges to use?
I would say great idea to do that if the patient is willing to.
Okay.
You know, that's where you get into those sort of discussions around disclosure about what do you disclose and to whom. If the patient is willing to, absolutely great idea to let them know.
Okay, great.
You know, the more you can engage family, let them know, and to some extent even coach the family around, you know, from the patient's perspective, if he calls and says, I'm really struggling, I'm really craving, what would be helpful to do in that moment? So if you can provide
awesome.
Some coaching to the family around that too, I think that's huge.
Thank you.
Yeah, great question. All right. So we're going to do a little tour de force on a couple of last topics here. So that we save a couple minutes at the end also for questions. I'm going to talk briefly about craving. So the next slide with craving on the top. This is really important for folks with opioid use disorder, really important to monitor this. And I think it's a good way to think of this as similar to an emotional state where it both has components of reactivity and regulation. So how strongly is somebody craving and in what context? But there's also how well can somebody actually downregulate or inhibit that? You know, to some extent, medication is probably the most helpful thing for that reactivity. Behavioral therapy can really help with the regulatory part, is how do you manage it? What do you do when it does pop up? And if you go to the next slide, I put some questions here. This is a craving assessment. It's actually based on a measure that Roger Weiss developed a number of years ago, originally for cocaine, that measures craving. And I put this up here because this is actually something that I use clinically myself that we've looked at in research. And it's very, very simple. It's three items. All you have to do is average the three items. And we've done some longitudinal work with this. And if for every one unit increase, so if someone is, you know, typically walking around at a 4, let's say, and they come in 1 week and they're up to a 5, for that every one unit increase, their likelihood of using in the next week goes up about 17%. So that's actually a pretty big uptick for a small shift in craving. So this is something that I really do. I administer week to week. I keep an eye on it. I keep an eye on, you know, whether someone is shifting in some direction. And if they do go up a little bit, you know, I'm really sort of trying to circle the wagons for that person and figure out what do they need to do to stay safe in the next week. So I you know, whether it's this questionnaire or whether it's something simpler, this offers a little bit better prediction than just asking about urges. But even if you just have time to ask about urges, it is worth doing because it is generally a marker for increased risk of use. And actually, those data are on the next slide if you take a look at that. Moving on to the next slide with coping with craving. Again, I tend to fold this into the coping plan in general. along with coping with other kinds of things. But certainly, as with any kind of affect, getting people to identify and differentiate these states, to label them accurately, is a useful strategy. You know, am I craving right now? Am I feeling pain? Am I just hungry? Am I stressed? Actually getting people to accurately label that, to normalize the experience of craving, that it will happen, that it will pass, much like an emotion will. And similarly, really engaging people in coping strategies on that can be useful. Moving on to the next slide, a couple of things that I want to talk about, again, that are particularly opioid specific. So I'm going to talk briefly about low mood. I'm also going to talk about sleep and about pain. So with low mood, this is a tremendous issue for people, particularly in the three-ish months of early abstinence, where the opioid has just been hammering away at that reward system enough that it's dropped their set point. So if you think of, if your reward system is functioning normally and something good happens, you go to your kid's soccer game or you get good news or your favorite song comes on the radio, you get a little bit of a bump and you should feel some positive mood. When you've hammered away at that reward system, your set point has dropped. So you might have that same good experience and you don't actually feel good mood. It's not taking you up enough to get that benefit. The problem is when you do those things and you're not getting that benefit, it's really hard to continue doing them. So again, I think of someone who I had worked with, really nice guy, adored his kids, loved going to their sports games. And in early recovery, he was saying, I feel awful. I feel terrible about myself because I go to these soccer games or basketball games and I don't enjoy myself and I'm miserable and I feel awful for not enjoying myself. So he was starting to avoid them, which is actually going to exacerbate that low mood. So if you look at the next slide there, you see the cycle of low mood where my low mood motivates me to isolate, to decrease activity. I then don't get the natural reinforcers that I should be getting from my environment, which then further worsens that low mood. So this can be a real tremendous problem. I would say this is anecdotal. I don't have data on this, but I would say for most people, this really does start to shift about 3 months in. Can happen a little bit quicker, can happen a little bit slower, but getting people through that 3 months is really important. If you click onto the next slide, a couple of things that are important here. I say this to people, and this actually drives people crazy, but I think it's an important point, is the fact that motivation should precede behavior is a myth. I make the argument that motivation can be overrated, that in many cases, in the clinical example I just used, for that person, behavior would later beget motivation. The more he's getting into those systems, the more that reward system will reset, and eventually they will start to feel more positive affect in that situation, they will become more reinforcing. So just getting people to show up is essential. Getting naturally rewarding activities, find out what is naturally rewarding for somebody is really important. Getting structure around those so that they're not making a decision in the moment. Again, to go back to exercise, you never want to make a decision in the moment about whether or not to exercise because there's always something else. You're busy, you're hungry, you're tired. Is if you make that decision ahead of time that I'm going to exercise, you know, at 6 o'clock tomorrow morning or 6 o'clock tonight, you want that structure on board. The last point to make on positive affect here is oftentimes people misinterpret what builds positive affect day to day. It's generally not the big things, it's the little things. And getting people to attend to what are the small things that bring about some positive affect. can be something as small as listening to music or, saying thank you to the person who held the door for you. Those seem like teeny things, but getting people to actually attend to those things is a really important piece of engaging in positive affect. I guess 2 minutes on sleep really quickly. I mentioned earlier, sleep disruption is a huge issue in this population. I would actually make a plug for, in many cases, a sleep study can be indicated for folks. Sleep disordered breathing can be a real problem. Sleep apnea is really common. There's some mixed evidence that RLS can be really common in this population. So it, in many cases, getting a sleep study, if the resources are there to do that, can be useful. I continue to be discouraged by the data on treating sleep in this population. We know very little about how to treat sleep and substance use disorders as a whole. We know basically nothing about how to treat sleep disorders in people with opioid use disorder. If the alcohol literature is any use, it tells us that, much like in the general insomnia literature, CBT tends to actually be the treatment of choice, even though it is quite difficult to access. I have a couple of things on this on the sleep disruption slide that might be useful. There are some good web-based and mobile app-based resources. One that I'll often recommend to people because it's free is CBTI Coach. That was developed by the VA in collaboration with the Sleep Medicine Group out at Stanford. Very easy to use. Again, it's a free mobile app that I recommend to folks a lot. But a couple of just good behavioral principles here. If you were to pick some sort of low-hanging fruit, you know, whenever I do a CBT for insomnia group, we always talk about this as the golden rule, which is this is essentially, in many respects, stimulus control, which is don't go to bed if you aren't tired, don't stay in bed if you aren't sleeping. And you can sort of add to this, you shouldn't be doing other things in bed, like work or eating or talking on the phone. And in many respects, just getting people to, when they're not sleeping, when they're tossing and turning and frustrated and staring at the ceiling, getting them the heck out of bed. Going in another room, doing some kind of relaxation or reading or anything sort of quiet and calming, and then trying to get to sleep again. I'm sure everybody preaching to the choir on minimizing caffeine and alcohol. You do get there's the rare person who's a very quick caffeine metabolizer, but as a general rule, you want to figure 4 hours from consumption of caffeine to peak level in the brain. So you can have people do the math on that. Avoiding naps, certainly, and light exposure. You know, this is one of my favorite things, is the people who will take oral melatonin while they watch TV in bed, which is basically stepping on the brakes and stepping on the gas at the same time. We know that light coming into your eyes is what regulates melatonin naturally in the brain. So getting the TV, cell phones, laptops, getting everything out of the bedroom, really minimizing light exposure prior to bed. A full course of CBT is optimal, but these are some things that can be pretty easily implemented. And shifting gears to the last slide here, I have to talk about pain as well before I open it up to questions. This is the most common reason for why people start misusing opioids. Even starting misuse, even the people who don't start with a legitimate prescription, the majority of people report that their first opioid use was to help mitigate pain, particularly in the sort of cohorts over the last 20 or 30 years that have been characterized by more prescription opioid misuse. We do know that chronic pain status alone does not appear to necessarily worsen opioid use disorder outcomes, but fluctuations in pain week to week do. So much like craving, keeping an eye on fluctuations in pain, has someone had an acute uptick in pain? Because if so, again, they're going to be at greater risk for relapse in the upcoming week. Certainly there are many effective non-opioid strategies for pain. For the sake of time, I won't go into those, but between non-opioid medication strategies, of which there are a number, behavioral and complementary medicine strategies, there's some pretty good data for mindfulness, for CBT, for pain. In many respects, it's similar approaches to some of the things that we already talked about, including tolerance of distress and getting people to engage actively in coping. That's a big piece of those interventions. For someone with significant pain, buprenorphine may be a better medication option than going with naltrexone or the extended release naltrexone. So getting those pieces also addressed on the medication end can be of some use. But again, much like craving, addressing pain, if that is part of the picture, and even if someone doesn't have chronic pain, it looks like somewhere of 80% or more of people with opioid use disorder will have at least some intermittent significant pain. So even if someone does not come in with a chronic pain condition, it's worth taking a look at that and seeing if that's something you need to address. And that is my last, so you can click through. The last one was just whether folks have any additional questions about any of that.
Hi, this is Mark. First of all, I want to thank you. That was a wonderful talk and very practical, very very useful information. One of the thoughts I had is in terms of finding competing reinforcers, one of the most memorable things a patient of mine said to me was that giving up fentanyl for her was like being kicked out of the Garden of Eden. And how do I compete with that, basically? And it kind of, as much as I believe in a functional analysis, sometimes I think that doesn't take it all the way. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. That is, and it's true. For many cases, the euphoria associated with opioids, that is tremendously hard to compete with. You know, the example I think of this, and I think one thing that, and again, this is where you see some of the dysfunction in learning, is I still remember the very first person I ever worked with was in grad school. It was at a methadone maintenance clinic outside of Boston, and it was someone who had said, the first time I used heroin was the best I've ever felt in my life, and I've spent every day since then trying to chase that feeling.
Right.
So I think for many people, that Garden of Eden actually doesn't continue. Is that at some point they actually get diminishing gains.
I think that's absolutely true, although what I realize is that the tack I needed to take with this woman was not so much, oh, you know, you're going to enjoy your children more, but I have to honor your sacrifice in giving that up.
Yeah.
There was a different way to deal with it.
It's interesting, I've actually a colleague who talked a lot about that there is, he describes it as almost a grieving process. That you are choosing to give something up. Great point.
This is Sherry Knapp Brown. I couldn't help thinking as I listened to the strategies how much some of the DBT skills can be useful, because I also use DBT with CBT. I don't know if you're familiar with that dialectic behavior therapy.
Yeah, absolutely.
But they're like distress tolerance skills that are all around. You could use to manage those really strong cravings and urges to just slow down, don't take action, and it will pass sort of thing. I think of the accumulating positive skill, which is around helping you attend to those positives that I think the people using substances often almost don't attend to anymore. They think of the drug as being the only way.
Yeah.
So
it's a great. I think DBT is great for this population. The other thing that I, to your point of DBT, I think can be tremendously. I use a lot of DBT skills with folks, but also ACT, acceptance and commitment therapy, particularly the values-based component of that, I think can also be really helpful too. And this almost circles back a little bit to what Mark was saying around, you know. Feeling like giving up fentanyl was giving up this woman's spot in the Garden of Eden is also engaging people positively around their values and reconnecting with their values and you know, if we are just in a take away the bad stuff mode, I think we're leaving people in a tough spot. There's also a rebuilding process that's really important.
Right.
And for some, it's not even a rebuilding process as much as a building for the first time, especially when they started so young.
Yep. Yeah, there's we had looked at this a few years ago. We had done some research on this construct of belongingness, and it was actually a really poor predictor of outcome that the more someone felt like their identity, their entire sense of efficacy, was sort of wrapped up in the opioid use culture, where it was, you know, all of my friends use substances, and I feel like I'm really good at sort of making things work and getting my hands on substances. But people also just really felt like a fish out of water with many of the things that we're trying to engage them in. You know, I don't want your job training program. This is Greek to me. So I think that the folks who are really and have been wrapped up in that culture from a young age, I think it's a very tough process for them.
Well, listen, we've only got a couple of minutes left, and I wanted to once again thank you. That was really a terrific talk. And, you know, on the one hand, I learned stuff. On the other hand, it really validated some of the stuff I've already been doing. So it's always wonderful to hear that somebody else has come up with the same approaches and same outlook. And,
this is excellent. Thank you very much.
And I wonder if
this is a great presentation. Thank you.
I'm wondering if it'd be possible for you to send us some information on the CBTI app, or is that something?
Oh yeah,
look up.
Happy to do that.
Yeah, and I could disseminate that to the group.
Yeah, I'll forward that to you before the end of the day.
You're good. Well,
thank you. Thank you so much. This is again. I appreciate everybody. Taking the time and such great thoughts and questions. Really appreciate it.
Yep. Thank you. So everybody have
thank
a
you very much.
So much.
Thank you so much.
Hey, Mark, you still there? It's George.